It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard around the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I am your host, Mark Young. I was about to say Dr. Mark Young, because actually that's correct. Regardless of that, Chuck is still on location today. He will be back in our next episode. So what we're going to do today is our producer, Patrick O'Brien, is in the booth here with me. And we're going to answer listener questions. That's what we're how we're going to attack this and talk about just a whole variety of things. So let's lead off here. First off, before we get into that, I want to talk something about this crime rate thing. We are seeing shootings going through the roof right now. New York up 200%, LA up, I think, 260%. Chicago, 4th of July weekend, Chicago with 90 people shot. And Lori Lightfoot and Bill de Blasio says the reason for the increased shootings is coronavirus. Coronavirus is causing people to go out and shoot them. And I know, if you shot anybody, you've had to deal with coronavirus. You haven't shot anyone, right?
Nope.
So I haven't shot anybody. But for some reason, the coronavirus is causing this big spike in crime. It has nothing to do with defunding police departments, nothing to do with New York taking 600 crime prevention officers, plainclothes officers off the street, or telling the city they're going to cut $1 billion out of the budget, which is absolute nonsense. In New York, when we look at New York, they literally had a thin blue line of 600 plainclothes officers that was holding back a storm of violence. Because these plainclothes guys are the ones that are taking the illegal guns off the street. And now they're not there. You look at LA, Minnesota, you know, Minneapolis, Chicago, just the knowledge, just telling the criminal element that we're cutting police, just telling them that police are bad, the police can't, you know, shouldn't bother you, is sending these people into the streets to commit more crime. In Chicago, they're just going up to, they're literally pulling up to houses, three or four people, and just machine gunning up parks and front yards, children being murdered. And we do not see one member of Black Lives Matter protesting any of these deaths. Now, if Black Lives Matter was actually the purpose behind that organization, rational behavior would tell you, you are always going to focus on the low-hanging fruit first. If our goal is to save Black lives, then we should always be sending our attention to the place where we can save the most lives first. And then once we fix that problem, let's move to the next place where we would lose Black lives. So obviously the number one place that we would save Black lives would be with Planned Parenthood, because they're aborting 1 million Black lives a year. And almost 80% of the locations are within two blocks of a African-American neighborhood. The second place we would go is we'd start going to the streets of New York, streets of Chicago, Minneapolis, LA, Atlanta. Crime is so bad in Atlanta now that they've declared a state of emergency to bring in the National Guard. Now, why do they need to bring in the National Guard? Because the cops don't want to go to work. Because the cops have been told, if you do your job, we're going to charge you with murder. If you do anything, if you follow the rules of engagement, if you do your job according to the way you were trained, you just may end up in prison for it.
So regardless of defunding the police, how do you fix this in cities like Chicago, New York, now Atlanta?
We saw this happen with New York and Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani, when New York was an absolute disaster after years of David Dinkin and Ed Koch. And you're a little young to remember this, but no one wanted to go to New York because it was a killing field. I mean, you would have probably more likely decided to, you know, to go to Mosul than to go to New York, you know, because it would be safer there. Rudy Giuliani understood a concept which is called the broken window theory. And broken window theory was a sociological study. And I'll give you the background real quick. What they discovered in the broken window theory was that if you took an abandoned factory, so these old abandoned factories that have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of windows in them, and they found that if somebody threw a rock and broke one window, within days, if not hours, someone would break another window. And the more windows were broken, the more windows were broken faster. Then they discovered that if they take that broken factory and somebody throws a rock and breaks one window, if they would rush in and replace that one window, then the odds on somebody breaking more windows went down dramatically. And the reason is because when we break the window and we allow it to be broken, we're telling the world destruction is okay here. When we replace the window, we're telling people, no, it's not okay here. It's the reason why anyone who knows how to run a city wants to remove tags and graffiti the next day. Now, we've experienced it here at our own building. We've had somebody put graffiti in the building. We immediately the following day get rid of it. And then nobody shows back up and puts any more on. If you leave that graffiti on there, you'll come back tomorrow and you'll find more graffiti on it. Come back tomorrow and you'll find more graffiti on it because it becomes acceptable. So the mayor knew this. So he followed a principle of zero tolerance. And where he started to put his focus on was in the transit police. So in New York, they actually have a separate police department that are transit cops. And they just work the subways and all that stuff. So there was a big problem when he became mayor of people jumping the turnstiles to ride the subways. And it was epidemic. People would just go down the stairs, go in the tunnel, jump over to the turnstile, and get on the subway and ride for free. He ordered the transit cops to arrest everybody for jumping the turnstile. And keep in mind, we're arresting people because they just cheated a dollar or $1.50, whatever the case was. What he would further do is he had the transit cops take those defendants, line them up against the wall in the subway, and handcuff them all together. And they would stand there for hours. So all of a sudden, there was 8, 10, 12, 20 people lined up, handcuffed, for everyone on the subway to see. So people are going to the subway, and here's all these people handcuffed together in a big chain lined up against the wall of the subway. What he was able to do with that, he was able to show the criminal element that we don't tolerate anything, even if it's cheating $2. And the criminal element starts to get the idea, well, if they're going to make you sit a night in jail for $2, what's this mayor going to do to me if I rob a gas station? Or what's he going to do to us if we go and get arrested for a gun charge? And that's what drove New York down. Now, it drove New York down to a point where New York became one of the safest big cities in the world. Then came along Mayor Bloomberg. Now, to Bloomberg's credit, Bloomberg kept that going, and Giuliani recognizes that. You know, Bloomberg does some crazy things sometimes, but he kept the law and order going. Then came Bill de Blasio, and de Blasio is a devout socialist. So what happened in New York? Well, what did they do? They got rid of cash bail. So now in New York, you can commit a crime, go to the police station. An hour later, you're back on the street. New York has literally had people arrested for bank robbery and let them out, and they went and robbed another bank yet that day. So the first thing the criminal element knows is, only if I get caught, I'm only going to be tied up for a couple hours. And I'll be back out. The second thing, you get rid of 600 cops and there's nobody there to take those guns off the street, plus you cut in budget. So back to your question, how do you fix it? You fix it with zero tolerance. You fix it by letting people know that laws matter. That if you commit a crime, we're going to do something about it. That's how you fix it. All right, so what's our next question?
So kind of sticking on that topic here, I want to talk qualified immunity. What is it? Should we have it? I know we discussed this a little off air. Mm-hmm. And then also on top of that, police unions, should we have them? What would our country look like without them? Are they all good, all bad?
Okay, so let's do qualified immunity. So qualified immunity is the protection that law enforcement and other government officials have from being sued personally in the execution of their government jobs. So most people in government have qualified immunity. This is the reason why the citizens of the CHOP can't sue the mayor personally in Seattle, even though she's personally the reason why their lives were ruined for a month. They can sue the city, but they can't sue the individual. What the Democrats are demanding is that we take qualified immunity away. What they want to happen is that if a police officer does something that they deem wrong, that the individual victim can now sue the cop personally. If you eliminated qualified immunity, it would probably be next to impossible to recruit anyone to be a police officer. Now, meanwhile, you notice the Democrats are against eliminating qualified immunity for the FBI. Now, imagine if people like Strzok and Comey and Brennan and all these people could be sued personally by General Flynn or Roger Stone or Corey, or who's what I'm thinking of?
Papadopoulos.
Yes. Imagine if they could all sue these people personally. But we don't want that. We don't want that. We just want street cops to be able to be sued personally. So the reality is qualified immunity, it needs to stay in place. You know, let's look at this thing here. We need to get rid of qualified immunity because Black Lives Matter says so. Because Black Lives Matter is out to stop all of this injustice of these racist cops who are out killing blacks. As we've said before, in the past year, there's been 9 black suspects, 9 unarmed black suspects killed by police. All 9 of them did have substantial criminal histories. That does not constitute an epidemic. Meanwhile, we let 90 black people get shot in Chicago, including children killed, and that's okay. And why is that okay? Well, apparently, if a black person shoots a black person, it's not a problem. The problem only becomes if a white police officer shoots a black person, which happened 9 times, which wouldn't even be Friday night in Chicago. So again, tell me how Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter, if you look at the organization, the goals of the organization is the destruction of the American government, to dismantle the Constitution, to drive President Trump out of office, and to convert America into a Marxist country. We're talking Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, China. It's to make that kind of government, government that controls every aspect of your life. What's our next one?
And you kind of answered a question from Carolyn Holmes there, who wanted to know, what does BLM really want?
Yeah, they... That's a pretty simple answer. They want, the founders of BLM, first off, they believe they're going to force Donald Trump into resigning, which already shows you how disconnected from reality they are. Because the more you tell this guy to do something, the more he's going to tell you, I'm not going to do it. Their second goal is the destruction of the U.S. government, to bring down our system of government, to wipe out liberty, to wipe out the Constitution, and to instill a Marxist government. They want to be Venezuela. They want to be Cuba. They want to be North Korea.
Not to mention most of their funding goes right to Act Blue.
Correct.
And goes right to candidates across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that support them.
So police unions, being an ex-cop, I know you've spoke about this mm-hmm. on the show before. Is that where the reform should really start?
So police unions don't, most police unions do not tend to behave in the fashion of other unions. So when we think of auto workers or Teamsters or truckers or something, or school teachers, we think of unions where people are out on the picket line and they're striking and they're doing these things. Most police unions are more of a fraternal organization than a union. So the biggest police union in the country is actually the Fraternal Order of Police. And it's more akin to being a member of the Moose Lodge or the Eagles or the Masons than it is being in a union. The purpose behind them, you'll have patrolmen and corporals, which will be in something like that. Then there's usually like a sergeants and lieutenants group. And then sometimes there's groups above that, but usually it's the patrolmen, corporals, sergeants, lieutenants. They do act as collective bargaining units. And in the bigger cities, the big cities like a New York or a DC or something like that, they do provide union reps and legal defense to police officers that are charged with police brutality and things of that nature. Now, keep in mind that it's real easy for any cop today to be charged with excessive force or police brutality, because people are accusing them of doing all kinds of things right now. You see people screaming in their faces as they stand still and are just screaming and spitting on them, calling them names. So the idea of the public filing complaints against police officers for excessive force frivolously is extremely high. The cops need to have a union in this particular case because you can't always afford the defense, because attorneys are expensive and you need to have that defense. Now, on the flip side of that, there are a few unions who have cut union contracts that make it extremely hard to fire a cop. So like we know that, what's his name? Chauvin in Minneapolis had something like 17 or 19 complaints against him. And he had a union that made it hard to fire him. Understand, the people who signed that union contract were Democrats. It was a Democrat council and a Democrat mayor that signed that contract with the police union. Now, is it the police union's fault that they ask for as much as they can get.
No, so this looks like city council would be
correct.
Held accountable.
Doesn't any employee want to get paid as much as they can?
For sure.
Doesn't any employee want to have as much benefits as they can?
Absolutely.
Or have as much leniency for making mistakes as they can? That's normal. But you have a Democrat council and a Democrat mayor who signed it. So the reform isn't in the union. The reform is in the contract.
Well, and this gets back to something I know Chuck has talked about extensively on the show, that it all starts at the city level. Your city council is more dangerous than you think it is.
Absolutely. People don't pay attention to it. But in reality, do we blame the union for asking for as much as they can get? No, that would be ridiculous. You blame the people you elected to keep you safe. So if the mayor and the council looks at a union proposal and says to that union, we need changes in these areas because we need to weed out bad cops. Guess what? They'll negotiate it and they'll get it back. But you have Democrats in these cities. Now, keep in mind, every city that's had rioting, every city that's having a cop killed a black guy is still in a Democrat-run city.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, Atlanta hasn't been, they haven't had a Republican mayor.
This is 1800s.
Yep, that's correct. So
these are cops who work for Democrat bosses. And these are cops that are doing what they were trained for by the mayor and the council and the police chief.
Would you be in support of better training? Hand-to-hand combat training?
First off, I can tell you that most police have almost no hand-to-hand combat training. You have some in the academy, and for the next 20 years, you won't have any more, unless maybe you're in a SWAT team. I actually taught some hand-to-hand combat to cops when I was younger, because I have a martial arts background, but it was voluntary. Cops weren't required to be there if they wanted to come to a class and learn, you know, some stuff. But there was no regular hand-to-hand combat. So here's one of the issues we've had. This is a sowing and reaping situation. When I first became a cop, you had to have a minimum height of 5'9". You had to master a number of physical challenges. You had to master weapons. You had to requalify with the weapons every 6 months. And there was weight and height requirements all through your career. So you had fitness requirements. Democrats wiped those rules out. Because Democrats said, well, telling people they have to be 5'9" is too restrictive for women. That means women aren't as likely to become cops. They lowered the testing because they said that the entrance exams for becoming a cop was too prone toward white people and wasn't fair to black people. So they lowered the standard of how smart you had to become a cop. So they lowered the height. They lowered the standards. Then they lowered the weight and height restrictions. Then they got rid of, many of the cities got rid of having to have a clean police record. And they said, well, you could have some misdemeanors as long as they weren't violent. You can still be a cop. This was all done in the on the altar of equality. We wanted to make the police department, and what they did is they turned the police departments into a social experiment.
Similar to the military, though, when they lowered standards.
Yep. So now when we look at police departments today, and again, I'm not making fun or picking on people under 5'9". But I am saying that when a 5 foot person or a 5 foot four person tries to have a physical confrontation with a 6 foot four George Floyd, it probably won't work out well. So what happens? Well, what happens is the cop's not physically large enough to overpower the defendant. So we're either going to have to use multiple cops, or we're going to have to use weapons, or we're going to have to use chokeholds because we can't control them. We created this environment. By the way, the Democrats created this another environment just like it. The same environment they created is in mental health. Okay, now, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have mass encampments of homeless people living all over the streets. The reason is because we had homeless people in mental institutions. Because most people who live on the street have mental issues. But Democratic leadership came along and said, you're discriminating against crazy people. You know, crazy people are humans too, they have rights. So we had to stop treating people as if they were criminals because they were insane. So they did away with being able to put people into these mental hospitals. And many of these institutions have been shut down now and torn down, and they don't exist. And that's why we have these people on the streets. All of this stuff that is done under the auspices of equality, many of these things have unintended consequences, which the government, especially on the left, is incapable of anticipating. And I'll give you a, for instance, it's happening right now. Congress right now passed a law giving everybody on unemployment $600 over and above their state unemployment. So now the average person on unemployment is making $900 to $1,000 a week. 70% of people on unemployment are earning more on unemployment, considerably more on unemployment than they did working. Now they won't go back to work. I'm talking to business people all over the place who are fighting with their employees. And these are employees who are, you know, lower income employees. They won't come back. Why should I come back to work? Why should I work for less money? The government themselves created a system to overinflate unemployment. And now the Democrats want to say the president hasn't lowered the unemployment rate.
And not only that, it destroys our supply chain, which was already blown out from the pandemic and the shutdowns across the country.
Right, because you have businesses that can't get people to come and work. We had a window washing company that services us. And we were talking to the window wash people, and they were running behind. So why are you guys so far behind? Well, we have 8 trucks, but we can only get enough employees to come back to work to run 3 of them. Because the other employees won't come back because of the unemployment's too high. Hi, folks. I want to take a minute right now to talk to you about the most amazing item ever, the most amazing product ever. It is called H2 Max, molecular hydrogen. And no, it is not a bomb. Sounds like one, but it's not. H2 Max is molecular hydrogen that you drop a tablet in water. You can use 2 or 3 of them. It will effervesce in the water, and you are drinking billions of hydrogen bubbles. Now, why would you want to drink hydrogen bubbles? It's simply this. Hydrogen is amazing what it can do for the human body. Hydrogen acts against inflammation. So it goes at the root cause of inflammation. It doesn't work like a Motrin or something like that. It goes at the root cause of it. Here's what I want to tell you. I took this product and I gave this product to one of my closest friends. And this is a guy who's been racing motocross for 50 years or close to it, 45 years racing motocross. He's broke every bone in his body probably three times. I was sitting in a restaurant with him one night and he was telling me, I just want to sob tonight. And I'm like, why? What's wrong? He goes, I just hurt so bad. I can barely get up and down. I need to find a rheumatologist. I'm just so tired of this. And I said, well, what's your pain level at? He says, and this is a guy with a very high pain tolerance. And he says, you know, probably like an 8 or a 9 right now. So I said, wait a minute. And I went out, I had some H2 Max in my motorcycle. I went out and grabbed it. I put three of them in a glass of water. I said, all right, buddy, drink this in a minute after it bubbles up. He drinks the water. And he's like, okay, I drank the water, the fizzy water, whatever. About 10 minutes later, he starts standing up in his chair and he's sitting down, standing up, sitting down, standing up, sitting down. I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, I'm not hurting. He goes, I haven't stood out of a chair in 10 years without having to pick myself up with my hands. And then he starts stretching his fingers and he's like, oh my God, I can feel my fingers right now. This happened in like 10 minutes time. Now, the reason is because when hydrogen hits your body, it doesn't have to go through the digestive tract because hydrogen is such a small molecule. It just hits the body and it permeates its tissues and it starts working. This guy now lives on this product. I can tell you instance after instance after instance of this happening. If you know someone who is living in chronic pain, arthritis pain, fibromyalgia, you know, sciatica pain, anytime, not acute pain, not I just stubbed my toe pain. I'm talking about chronic pain. You have to try this or give this to the people that you care about. It's H2 Max. You can get it at buyh2max.com. That's buyh2max.com. You can get a 30 count or a 90 count. Try it and let me know what happened. Chuck wants to know what happened. You're going to be amazed by this. I promise you. What's our next one?
So we're going to move into something that we've talked about. It kind of goes with the defunding of police. Should people be arming themselves today? I know you've said that you've talked to many people that have run out and bought their first guns. Shelves are cleaned out of guns and ammo. Very few left anywhere.
It's a good question, Patrick. So I've had so many phone calls from people saying, I've never owned a gun. I've never shot a gun. Do you think I should get a gun? Will you teach me how to use a gun? Here's my first comment to people that are thinking about buying a weapon and getting their first gun. And let me preface this by saying the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees you have the right to bear arms. So take nothing that I say as me, you know, disagreeing with the Constitution. Everyone has the right to keep and bear arms. What I want people to think about is when you decide that you're going to buy a weapon and or carry a weapon, you first have to ask yourself the question, do I have the willingness and the capacity to take another human life? Because you will need to be willing to do that. You have to understand, there was a case here in Detroit just last week where a woman bumped into a black teenager. Her mother started screaming at the woman. It was a husband and wife. Started screaming at the woman, calling her names, calling her white trash. The black woman immediately escalated this into a racial debate. Now, all the white women did was like tapped into her, getting, you know, walking past and tapped into her. And you're white trash, and why don't you apologize? And the woman's like, well, I'm sorry, I bumped into her. That isn't good enough. And just kept white trashing her. The couple got back in their car, tried to drive off, and all of a sudden the woman jumped behind their van and started beating on the back of their van and wouldn't let them out of a parking space. The white woman in the van, who legally carried a gun, exited her van and pointed her handgun at this woman and told her to back off move back so that we can leave. That woman is now charged with several felonies. And the reason is simply this. The reason I say you have to be willing to take a life is because you can never pull that gun out, which is called brandishing. You can never pull that gun out and brandish it or wave it at someone in hopes of you're going to deter them. One, they could have a gun and shoot you. Two, we're finding many of these people aren't even afraid when they pull out a gun. This woman pulled out a gun as a black woman. This black woman ratcheted up her verbal assault on her. That gun didn't impress her at all while her daughter is videoing it. So you cannot, what I want people to get out of their mind is carrying a gun is not a deterrent. You do not use it as a deterrent. Locks on your door is a deterrent. A gun is a deadly weapon. And when that gun leaves the holster, it is to end someone. It is to put someone down, which means, this is what you have to understand, if you carry a gun and you ever draw it and you ever fire it, assume you will be arrested. Assume that you may be charged with a crime and that you will have to defend yourself. So I'm going to add to that. If you ever do pull out that gun and use it, even let's say somebody breaks in your home and you shoot somebody in your own home, do not give the police a statement that night. You tell the police, I am upset. I'm rattled from what happened. I'm not comfortable giving you a statement right now. Let me collect my thoughts. I will be happy to come into your station tomorrow and sit down and give you a statement then. And you go in with an attorney and you make your statement. Now, this is assuming you did everything right. You're going to have this urge to tell the cops, he kicked my front door down, he had a gun, and I grabbed my AR-15 and he took one shot at me and I shot back and I hit him first. You're going to want to tell your story. Don't do it. Wait till tomorrow. Sit down with an attorney. Because the tide is against you right now. The tide in law enforcement is against the honest citizen and in favor of the criminal. So finally, where I was going with this is, when you pull that gun out and you use it, assume that at some point you are going to be in front of a jury of your peers, and what you will need to convince them is that at the moment you pulled that trigger, you believed in your heart and mind that your life was in under imminent danger of death or serious bodily injury or death or serious bodily injury to another individual in direct relationship to where you are located. So you thought you or your daughter, your friend, your wife was going to be murdered, and that's why you pulled it out. If you can't convince a jury that that's the case, then you don't pull the weapon out. So back to, should you buy a gun? Statistically, John Lott has shown that the more guns in a community, the safer the community is. So my global concept is, yes, everybody buy a gun. The more guns you have, the safer we are. On an individual basis, do you have the self-control? Do you have the willingness to end another human's life if you had to? And if you can cross those two lines, then yes, then go get a gun. If your idea is, oh, I'm never going to shoot anybody, I just want to wave it at people as a deterrent, don't go buy the gun. Go buy a pepper ball gun.
That was going to be a follow-up question. What do you think about non-lethal, whether it's a pepper spray gun or a pepper ball gun?
I like the pepper ball guns. There's several of them on the market. They shoot like a 61 caliber paintball. It's got a paintball in it that's filled with medical grade capsaicin. They shoot over 300 feet per second. You can shoot somebody from 150 feet. And if you fire one of those pepper balls at the ground in front of somebody, you'll disable them. So keep, and they look exactly the same as like a 1911, like a 45 caliber. So I like them, but you have to understand that first off, a pepper ball gun is no match to someone with a real gun. And there's lots of criminals with real guns. And two, a pepper ball gun isn't for the purpose of ending a crime. A pepper ball gun is a non-lethal device to give you time to run. So if you can disable the person for 15 seconds, 30 seconds, that's a window of you trying to get away. So to expand on that, Patrick, I would not use a pepper ball gun to defend my home because I have no place to run. If I'm going to pepper ball you in my foyer and I've got 15 to 30 seconds, am I going to run out and leave you in my house, or am I going to run in the bathroom and lock myself in the bathroom? So if somebody breaks in my house, I'm going to use deadly force. But somebody starts a fight with me in a parking lot and threatens to attack me. Let's say somebody threatens, you know, they're going to attack me. They're going to snatch my MAGA hat off my head. And there's a good example. Somebody goes to grab your MAGA hat off your head, which is an assault. Pepper spray, pepper ball would be fine. That's an assault. But it wasn't a deadly assault. I can't convince people I thought I was going to die when this person grabbed my hat. But I can convince a jury I was assaulted and I used a non-lethal device to stop the assault, which would be okay.
So Chuck, I want to give people a little tip here. I have this in my hand, although folks can't see it. Dermen Fragile Skin Lotion.
Yes.
This is the time to go get Dermen Fragile Skin Lotion, because if you're washing your hands all the time and using hand sanitizer with alcohol, your hands are aging oils. About 100 years.
You're right. They're going to turn purple.
Oh, my wife is just complaining that her hands are just so dry and cracking, and yeah, it's killing her. Because, you know, Sal, now she's essentially washing her hands about every 30 seconds. I think she's just going to walk around with a hose and just keep washing them. But, folks, I just want to tell you, this is Dermen Fragile Skin Moisturizing Lotion. Walmart, CVS, Walgreens, go pick this stuff up.
Dermen makes great products. I mean, their whole product line, I think, is just off the hook. It's awesome. Really great stuff.
But this is something you want to get for all the hand washing that we're going through right now.
So on to our next question, which was asked by two people, Cindy Kaiser and Patriot Pete. Well, Patriot Pete asked a different question as well, but Ron Mexico asked this. Do you believe Joe Biden will actually be the Democratic candidate, or are they playing a shell game? Who will his VP be?
Early on, it kind of looked like they might try to kind of skate the nomination, take it away from him, maybe go to Andrew Cuomo or something. At this point, it would appear the Democratic Party is too far down the rabbit hole with Biden now, because he's got everybody's endorsement. So if you yanked it from him now with everyone's endorsement, then who are you going to replace him with? Because you'd have to replace him with somebody who's endorsing it. What the Democratic Party is looking at right now, first off, Biden is the first presidential candidate in history to run for office and proclaim that he is a one-term president. No one has ever run for president and said, I'm only here for one term. The Democrats are looking at Biden right now as a placeholder. So the real race here is Donald Trump versus other. It's not Biden, it's other. So President Trump is actually defining both sides of this race. No one is standing in line, I can't wait to go vote for Joe Biden. They are either, I can't wait to support the president, or I can't wait to vote against him. And Biden is other. Depending on whose poll you look at, 30 to 50% of the country now agree that Biden has dementia and still supporting him. So I do think he'll be the nominee. As far as the VP pick, I would probably say Kamala Harris is probably out front. Susan Rice is, you know, a possibility. Stacey Abrams.
She desperately wants it.
Well, she already thinks she is the vice president, but she also thinks she's the governor of Georgia. So she almost is in the business of running shadow governments. If she doesn't get it, she's probably going to run for it anyways. And there's one other candidate, is a congresswoman, that is a possibility. But I'm going to say Kamala Harris is probably who he picks. The bottom line is he already committed, he already stupidly committed that he would only pick a female, that which was a dumb move on his part, because, again, it's plain identity politics. Any rational person would know the best person to pick for VP is the best person available for VP, regardless of what flavor they are. Because you wouldn't pick based on, I'm a woman, I'm gay, I'm black, I'm green, I'm a Martian. You would pick based on, this is the person who I believe can best support my agenda and can best lead the country if I'm unable. Biden already committed to a female. Now, in the light of Black Lives Matter and in the fact of Biden now saying, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black, he's stuck picking a black VP. So his choices are very minimal.
So on to the next question here. This is something that's kind of popped up recently. We've seen it, I'm not sure across the country, but we have seen it here in Michigan at grocery stores, the nationwide chain shortage where they are not accepting cash to pay for your groceries.
You know, the chain shortage thing is I haven't spent a lot of time looking into it. Now, certainly everybody, you know, most people listening to this probably have a pickle bottle someplace in their house, you know, with a jar of change in it. So there's certainly lots of change that is out of circulation. I happen to know that, you know, we've got a big bucket of change at my house because I don't carry change. So when I go to the store and I get change, I throw the change into the buck, into this container, because I don't want to carry a bunch of coins tomorrow. And it's just all rattling around. So I would say that there is a certain amount of coinage which is unnecessarily out of circulation.
Would it have anything to do with the lockdowns that kind of threw off that supply chain too, where the stores were doing more cash transactions before?
Well, I'm struggling that the change shortage is real. I'm struggling with the fact that it is real, because we've seen many other indications of government wanting to push us toward a cashless society. Governments are not big on cash. This is one of the reasons why they hate Bitcoin. Because bank cards and credit card transactions can all be tracked. Cash transactions can't. Now, typically the way that government tries to vilify cash is by saying that, well, it's the criminal element. If we can limit cash, then we can stop the underground economy. We can stop all these drug peddlers, which they couldn't care less about. We have a chain shortage right now, but we've had a cash shortage for the past several years already, Patrick. Call your bank. Here's an experiment. You can do it. Anybody listening, call your bank and tell your bank you want to come in today and pick up $10,000 in cash. I'm going to bet you there's an 8 out of 10 chance that when you call the bank and tell them you want to come in and get $10,000, your bank's going to tell you, we don't have $10,000. Now think about this. You're a bank. Why do you have a safe? What's your vault holding? What do you put in there? But most banks today cannot cash a $10,000 check. Now, on top of that, by the way, if you do take $10,000 out of your bank has to send a form to the IRS notifying the IRS that you took out $10,000. And if you were to do that a few times in a row, the IRS can come along and seize all your assets and declare you to be party to criminal behavior. And then now they froze all your money, now tell you to prove them wrong. But back to the chain shortage. I think the chain shortage is an extension of what we've already seen as a cash shortage. We've already seen banks with a cash shortage. Now I think we're seeing that the cash shortage was, let's say, a banking level. The chain shortage becomes a retail level. We just need a credit card. By the way, I've been in many stores since this so-called pandemic. I've been lots of places where they don't accept cash. You can't even hand them cash.
That's gone to most retailers now, I think, and even fast food places are doing the same, or you have to have the exact amount.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So before we move on to a couple questions about Black Lives Matter, Patriot Pete asked, can you send me a copy of your podcast on cassette?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't believe we own a cassette machine here. I'm not sure if Pete's being serious or not, but that would be quite challenging. But Pete, you can go to bluntforcetruth.com and just listen to it there. You don't even have to, you know, play it as a podcast. You can play it off the website if you want to. I think you could play it on YouTube, can't you? Don't we have it on YouTube? Or nope, you have to go to the website. So go to the website and play it there.
YouTube demonetizes us every time we log in. So true,
yes, because we're evil. All right, what's our next one?
So I don't remember the name that sent this, but does Black Lives Matter plan to start a political party? Or are they a political party already? Just a wing of the Democratic Party?
It's an interesting question. So they are a political force. There's no question about it. And they probably become one of the most powerful political forces in modern times. Are they a part of the Democratic Party? We certainly see the Democratic Party is sucking up to them as quickly as they can. Does the Democratic Party embrace Black Lives Matter? They probably at this point embrace the Marxism of Black Lives Matter. But we have to remember that the Democratic Party has a 200-year history of racism. The Democratic Party has always been bad for African Americans. The Democratic Party was the party of slavery. They were the party of Jim Crow. They were the party of the Black laws. They were the party that fought segregated schools. They were the party who kept Blacks from jobs. The Democratic Party is the party who created marriage licenses. And they created marriage licenses throughout the history of man. Marriage licenses always resided in the church. And if you wanted to find a marriage record, you'd go to the church where the couple was married. Democrats created government marriage licenses because they wanted to stop black men from being able to marry white women. So the Democrats have always been anti-black, but they will promote themselves as such. Now, could Black Lives Matter become a political party? It's an interesting question. It is possible, but it would only be viable if the Democratic Party ceases to exist. America is very much built on being a two-party system. We just don't function as a three-party system like they can in Great Britain. So you'd have to get rid of the Democrats. And there is history for this. Prior to the Republican Party existing, we had what was called the Whig Party, W-H-I-G. And the Whigs had many presidents. George Washington was a Whig and Jefferson was a Whig. The Whig Party finally imploded on itself and gave birth to the Republican Party, which Abraham Lincoln was then the first Republican. If the Democrat Party collapses, which I believe we are on the verge of seeing, then you could see a party rise out of BLM, although I'm not sure if they would call it Black Lives Matter, because no matter how you look at it, blacks still amount to 12.8% of the population. So it would be a party that by name would have a certain limitation to it.
So this comes from Julie Lubbers. Do you think Governor Whitmer will try to make masks in public, you know, force people to wear them? Legally, can she force them to wear them?
All right, so this is not just Governor Nit Whitmer who's doing this.
This is every Democratic state, and even Texas has implemented some mask requirements.
So this is very interesting law. Governors, depending on the state laws, depending on the state's constitution, governors are given different amounts of power. And these powers are considered emergency powers. So when there is a state of emergency, governors are granted these limited powers to be able to take steps to protect the citizens. But usually these emergency powers have short-term durations to them. They usually have things like 30 days, 45 days, and then the governor has to get the approval of the legislature. Now, here in Michigan, the governor has been ordering all these laws, and she's never even spoke to a member of the legislature.
She is now that we have a budget deficit of $3 billion.
So she will ask them for money, but she will not consult them on any of her draconian shutdowns. So under normal circumstances, a governor does not have the ability to create law, as a president does not have the ability to create law. So when you think of the United States, think of us as 50 countries united under one system, much like the EU is a bunch of countries united under the European Union. So we have our 50 countries. They all have their own president, which is called a governor. They all have their own Congress, which is the state legislature. And they all have their court system, just like our Supreme Court. And they're operated very much like a small country. Just like a president, governors cannot make laws. Only legislators can make laws. Governors and presidents carry out the laws. Courts rule on the differences. So short term, these governors can make these orders like wear masks and do these things. But there's a limitation. There is a time limit to this authority. They can't do it forever because you cannot claim that a state of emergency is forever, because if it is, it's no longer a state of emergency. It's the norm. We're now, this is our new normal. Therefore, it is not a state of emergency. Therefore, you now need to go to the legislature and ask the legislature to write laws. Now, could legislators write a law making masks mandatory? See, that becomes a different issue. And I'm going to say that they could. And the reason is, are there laws requiring you to wear clothing? You can't go to Walmart, although people do, but you can't go to Walmart naked and go shopping. I'm sure it is happening right now at a Walmart somewhere, but you're not supposed to go to Walmart naked and go shopping. So for a legislators to pass a law saying you cannot go in public in these places without this particular covering is probably legal.
So to stay on with the COVID stuff, your thoughts on vaccinations in general, and specifically if there was a vaccination for the coronavirus?
Right now, there is no proven vaccination for the coronavirus. Coronavirus is actually, the proper name for the coronavirus is SARS-CoV-2. The SARS pandemic that we had the fear of years ago was SARS-CoV-1. These are manually man-manipulated viruses that behave in an unnatural fashion. When these viruses are released into the public, into the population, it is normal for viruses to mutate back into their original state. The normal state of a coronavirus is an upper respiratory infection. So when you get a cold, you have the coronavirus. That's what your cold is. And that's the normal state. So one thing I will tell you is, one, I don't suspect that we're going to see the famed second wave, because researchers in Italy, who's ahead of us on the virus, are now seeing the virus morph into what? Upper respiratory infection. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. Nature has a way of being consistent. The second thing is, think about the original SARS virus. Did you ever have a vaccine for the SARS virus? No. Did you have a vaccine for Zika? A vaccine for AIDS? A vaccine for the MERS virus? None of these things have vaccines. There was a vaccine created for SARS-CoV-1. The vaccine had more side effects than getting the virus. So do I think that they will try to put a virus on the market and tell us it is a treatment for this? That I think is possible. Do I think there will really be a virus that can beat SARS-CoV-2? No, because as fast as you're making the virus, you
vaccine.
Or the vaccine, as fast as you make the vaccine, your technology can't be altered as fast as the virus mutates. This is one of the reasons why flu shots oftentimes don't work. Because when you get a flu shot, the flu shot had to be made 9 months in advance. So what the CDC and all the experts have to do is they have to guess at what strain of the flu will hit next year. If they guess right, then we have a good flu season. If they guess wrong, then people get the flu. And the reason is because they can't even guess at what a flu virus will behave like 9 months from now. And now they're going to be able to guess at what COVID-19 is going to turn into next. Whatever they come up with is going to be outdated by the time they have it proven to be safe. And by the way, you have governors and mayors that are saying they're going to remain shut down until a vaccine's available. So I think this is fascinating, because I'm waiting to see, was this California just going to shut down permanently, just leave the place shut down? Because they're not supposed to open up until they get it. But what a great, think about this, what an amazing opportunity to get rid of churches. Sorry, we can't let you sing and worship and be hugging and jumping up and down in your church until the vaccine comes out. Oh, darn, there's no vaccine. Guess you can't go to church.
So this one came from Powerhouse16 on Twitter. I want to know who is working with Trump to end this disgusting violence by the Klan with a tan.
All right. Some people could take his comment of Klan with a tan as being a pejorative. I do get his point that much of what BLM does is appearing to be very Ku Klux Klan in nature, except we've switched the skin colors. We see videos of BLM members heavily armed walking up to the windows of people at stoplights demanding reparations. We see them marching in 100 and 200 people strong, literally standing armies wearing fatigues and AR-15s yelling black power.
But not spreading the virus.
They don't spread the virus. There is little doubt that the Black Lives Matter, and let me say that the far left activist portion of Black Lives Matter very much resembles the old Ku Klux Klan of long ago. So from that standpoint, I would agree. Now, he's wanting to know who's working with the president. Well, first off, it's really easy to tell who's working with the president because none of the problems are in any state with a Republican governor and mayor. This is not a coincidence. It's not just because Democratic mayors are more compassionate and they allow them to protest. It's because Democrat cities are the cities where the police are the most abusive. We need to recognize that every place that a cop has shot somebody, there's a Democrat in charge. Now, as far as what's the president going to do about it?
And that brings up another question that's kind of tied to this. Should Trump send in troops to these cities, and is he legally allowed to do so?
So under normal conditions, the president, and this is the same thing like with FEMA. So let's go back to Katrina for a minute. George W. Bush took all kinds of heat for saying that FEMA, the federal government, didn't respond to Katrina in time. But in reality, George Bush was in touch with the mayor of New Orleans and with the governor of Louisiana from day one and was asking them what support they needed, what help they needed. And the governor and the mayor didn't ask for federal government until days into this thing. And then the president responded. Now, the reason is because in a natural disaster or in a case like these rioting, the states are autonomous. Remember I said earlier how we have 50 countries operating under one operating system. Well, the founding fathers, the principle of our Constitution is that the government that you should have the most daily interaction with, the government that should be most important in your life, is your mayor and town council, followed by the county, then followed by the state, then followed by the federal government. And the founding fathers' image was that the federal government would be so uninvolved in your life and so out of touch with you that you would rarely think about them. Now you can see how we have flipped that on its head now, where we now have the majority of the news that's watched today is about federal government, not about your local government. But your local government is where your attention is supposed to be. So because we were built with this model of protecting the rights of states, the president doesn't have the right to go marching into a state and take it over. But there are exceptions. Just like we said before, that governors have these certain powers during emergencies, presidents have emergency powers. So President Trump does have a tool at his disposal, and that disposal would be called an insurrection. If so, the CHOP zone in Seattle, That was really an insurrection. They claimed that they took land and claimed they were no longer a part of the United States. So that is an insurrection. The president could have moved on that. The president did ask Governor Inslee over and over, do you want us there? We'll be there to help. And he rejected the help.
Well, he didn't know what was going on until day five.
That's true. He was not aware of the CHAZ and the CHOP. But I will say this. I think after the November election, after President Trump gets reelected and he's not looking at a reelection, if more of this happens, I would expect to see him claiming more insurrections and just going in and dealing with it. Right now, he's dealing with reelection.
So they call him a dictator. Wouldn't a dictator go in there and squash this?
Yes, that's the point. They would, if he was being a dictator, he would be, first off, look at the coronavirus. What do you do with the coronavirus? We're going to let every governor set their own plans. What's he done with all these riots? We're going to let every governor and mayor set their own plans, but we're here to help. Same thing with coronavirus. We're here to support the governors. Even Cuomo and Newsom said that the president was doing amazing stuff to help them in the coronavirus. So right now he's doing what the federal government should do, which is there to back up the governors. But eventually that'll probably grow a little old.
So we can wrap up on this question here, which has become more prevalent during the whole coronavirus thing. The people's inability to differentiate between the internet, social media, and real life. With social media has just become such a hostile place, and it seems like that's transferring over into real life.
There's a lot of social media has had, you know, many good things that come out of it, but probably more negative things than good things. So one of the things interesting with social media is we know this from sociological studies, and that is that if we look at individuals from 20, 40, 60 years ago, and we look at interviews with people from decades back, and we ask them how many close personal friends they have, the further back you go, the more personal friends an individual has. Today, we're now at a standpoint where individuals have the fewest, even though they think they have 150 friends on Facebook, where humans now have the least amount of real social contact in history. Because real social contact is meeting in person. And people have foregone meeting in person for these very shallow digital relationships.
For likes or shares.
Yeah, it's something that people have heard me refer to, and Chuck and I both referred to it as dead hooker friends. And it's how many dead hooker friends do you have? And what is a dead hooker friend? A dead hooker friend is somebody who you can call 3 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, Patrick, I've got a dead hooker in the trunk of my car. And the only thing you say is, should I get some shovels and Visqueen, and where do you want me to meet you at? So how many of those friends do you have in your life? Sadly, most people have none. Maybe they're lucky if they have one friend like that today. Whereas 20, 30 years ago, that number was more of like three or four. And most people had three or four people that they could call on the phone and say, I need $1,000. I need $10,000. I need you to help me with, you know, the proverbial dead hooker. They have fewer relationships. The internet is very similar to, the simile to the internet is road rage. So we look at road rage, and you have two people giving each other the finger, swerving into each other's lanes, battling with, you know, two-ton weapons. and getting very angry and screaming out the window and making threats and doing stuff. And they do that because they're protected by this 4,000-pound steel box and the knowledge that I don't have to get out and I can get away. Now, if you took those same two people and you put them in a parking lot and they accidentally bump shopping carts, it would never escalate into what it escalates into on a highway, because they're face to face, they're unprotected, I'm vulnerable, I'm here in person, this person could grab me, it doesn't escalate. The internet has now taken road rage to yet another level, because now instead of having the 4,000 pound shield around me, I now have the shield of anonymity. Now I can use a fake name. Now I don't have to put my real picture up. Twitter is notorious for people who just troll people and call them names and insult them. And you always see these people have no followers. And you always see that these people have no personal identity or photograph. So it allows these people to become empowered, to be bullies, to feel like they're more than they are. There's one other thing I want to say about social media too, Patrick, and that is that we know from a lot of studies that the more time people spend on social media, the more depressed and anxious they become. And the reason is because social media is essentially made up of two major strings of information. One string of information is what is wrong in the world. So you go to social media and you see Trump is Satan, Trump's mother is Satan. You see all this craziness out there and you're just being driven down by it. You're being depressed by it. The other chain of data that is notorious in social media is, I'm going to refer to it as the living your best life issue. So here I am skiing, here I am in a race car, here I am with celebrities, here I am with my girls at this great club. People have a tendency to grossly overinflate what their own living conditions are, because I don't post the here I am working 9 hours at Walmart. So as humans, we tend to compare ourselves to other humans. We can't help ourselves but compare ourselves. So we look at these people who we are acquaintances with. We're not friends. I know Facebook has, you know, calls these people friends. These are not friends. These are at best acquaintances. And I'll tell anybody that if you go through your Facebook list right now, I guarantee you don't know everybody on the list. And I promise you, you don't know any more than 162 of them. Because the average human is only capable of having 162 relationships. And once we get past that 160 number, for us to remember another human being by face, name, voice, we drop another one. Another one falls from our memory. 160 relationships is all we can have. So anybody with more than 160 followers in social media doesn't know them. It's mentally impossible. But anyways, we have this thing about how we compare ourselves to other people. And this really takes a toll on young people, especially young women. So, geez, look at this. My friend's out partying every night. My friend's got this great car. My friend has got this better job. My friend is doing so much better than I'm doing in life. So we tend to think that we're failures, we're doing less, everyone else is doing better than us, because everyone else is showing an idealized version of their life, not the real picture of their life. So I don't know if that answered your question or not, but it's not reality. Well, folks, I think that's it for today. I hope we answered some questions. Hope you enjoyed the show. Chuck will be back on the next episode of Blunt Force Truth. If you enjoy the show, as always, send a link to other people. Leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Podcast One, iTunes, or anyplace else. And as always, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter or through email with any of your questions, and we'll pick them up. We'll pick some up with Chuck sometime. That's it for Blunt Force Truth. See you next week.
A better tomorrow starts today with Wendy's breakfast. A tomorrow that says bacon, not bacant. Where fresh eggs reign like opportunity. Honey butter goodness is spread. And the frosty is chinoed. And right now, tomorrow brings even more. Like a small frosty chino for just a dollar with any purchase kind of more. That's right, $1. At Wendy's, tomorrow's looking good.
Offer available for a limited time only at participating U.S. Wendy's.